The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is September 7th, 2013. A couple of items I want to start with before I begin on David Irving's assessment of Heinrich Himmler, which is according to a video of a recent meeting that he held talking about it. So, to begin here, in the Independent recently was a story which says, Nuremberg rallies to repair crumbling Nazi heritage site. Officials in the German city of Nuremberg have announced controversial plans to spend up to 70 million euros, which is, £60 million, on renovating the city's vast yet dilapidated Nazi Party rally grounds. Well, you know, I think you're all familiar with where that is. If not, you can look up the article. But I did visit that site when I was there, and it was probably the high point the biggest thrill that I had of all the places and the National Socialist sites that I went to, because the fact is it does still exist there, even though it is in terrible condition. And so much of it has been removed and taken away, but it's just, you're just grateful that it's still there. Well, it looks like they're going to fix it up a little bit, and what they say in this, they're going to keep it there because, of course, they want to make it into, they have this documentation site there, and, you know, they tell you all how terrible the National Socialist regime was, but the reason that they give for keeping it there says that they say that there would be this big, huge outcry in the world if they destroyed it, if they tore it all down. So that's good. What the Nuremberg mayor, I'm just going to give the basics of this, the Nuremberg mayor, Ulrich Mali, said that demolishing the buildings would provoke international outrage. So we are going to renovate the complex, but this does not mean that we are sprucing it up. He said that parts of the complex had been demolished in the 1960s to make way for housing, but it was now impossible to do that as the site was protected. So I don't know, is it a historic protected historical site? That's what it seems to be saying here. And some people, he said, have said they are in favor of allowing it to just continue to disintegrate, as it would symbolize the passing of an era that was meant to last 1,000 years. Well, if they do enough to keep it there, that's good, because it will show that the era hasn't yet passed. And the mayor pointed out that if the city allowed the buildings to decay unchecked, they would be obliged to fence them in and otherwise put off limits in order to protect the public. So he says, we have decided to renovate to a certain degree. But the renovation work will also ensure that graffiti left by Allied soldiers will remain untouched. Can you imagine? So, but we're not surprised, are we? So all the graffiti will still be there. They don't want to get rid of that. And so Allied soldiers' defacement, this is me saying this, is of historical importance. Actually, though, what's important for them is that the anti-Nazi messages they convey to present-day Germans and tourists, they want those messages still to be there. And they're going to carry out, they say, repairs on the mosaic ceiling of the Zeppelin Tribune's Golden Hall. I don't know. I'm not even familiar with that. Now, They also mentioned that this site was the centerpiece of Leni Riefenstahl's film of the 1934 Nazi Party rally, which they call a blatant Nazi propaganda film. But then they have to add that it is possibly the greatest documentary ever made. Yeah, because of German genius, that's why. But they don't want to say that. They say it's because of revolutionary techniques used to make it. And that the film remains banned in Germany. Did you know that? Another story that I'm not going to talk about really is that Rochus Misch died recently. He was 96 years old. Let's see, it was on Thursday. On Thursday he died. He was, they call him in this AP story from Berlin, you know, that AP has been Jewish for a long, long time already. And I will talk about Rochus Misch some at another time, maybe on Monday a little bit. And I might have to, you know, continue with some things of today's show that I don't get everything in. So we'll see what Monday might be, another mix of different things. But one thing that Misch said, one thing this article said that I want to point out. When they say that he died on Thursday, they say, one, he was one of the last of a generation that bears direct responsibility for German brutality during World War II. This nice man, you know? Oh, well. And then they end their article with, you know, Misch was Hitler's, well, they call him different things, but he was like a bodyguard. One of the bodyguards, or he was a driver, or he was sometimes functioned as a valet or just a general aide. But he was around for a long time. Now, they say that there's a funny story that Misch tells that they repeat at the end of this story. And it says that this was in 2005, and Misch was giving an interview to, maybe it was to the AP, and he was showing a bunch of photographs from his photograph album. And he says, here's Hitler, my boss. Ava, a friend of Ava. He's, you know, describing who's in the picture. He said, very normal, not like what is written. Then he turned the page to photos of Ava Braun in an idyllic setting and so on. And he was, he lit up when he said that. And then he remembered something. And he said, this small black dog comes running and gets under the fence. And Hitler said, my God, what is this, racial mixing? So I want to bring that out because, especially for those who want to believe that Hitler had nothing against Negroes. Oh, he liked Negroes just fine. Well, he sure didn't want them in Germany, except as visitors. Naturally, he was polite to all peoples. But it doesn't mean he included them as any non-German people as Germans, particularly non-white people. So now we're going to go on to this David Irving video, and it is titled David Irving on Heinrich Himmler, August 2013. If you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube. You can just type those words in there, and you will find it. It kind of surprised me that it was there. I first watched it on Tuesday, last Tuesday, I think it was, and I found out about it on Sunday. Paul Hickman brought it to my attention, which I you know, was grateful. And I thought then that but I didn't watch it until Tuesday. But I thought then that maybe I should talk about it. I couldn't get it out of my mind and so on. So it was actually posted on August 30th. Well, Irving gives his reasons why he thinks Himmler did the exterminating and was capable of it. That's basically, you know, he's looking for reasons, he's looking for motivations, he's looking for evidence, which is all not very convincing to most revisionists. But I want to give some reasons that I've come up with why Irving has selected Himmler for this dubious honor. Why is Irving writing this book about Himmler? Well, there's probably a whole list of things that could be said, but Seems to me that David Irving has to have an evil Nazism to placate both his English patriots and the Jews. You know, he cannot say that Hitler didn't do what you think he did, and therefore National Socialism was a fairly benign, was much more benign than is said, because Irving does identify with the English and with the greatness of England and so on. And he wants to be loved and admired in his home nation. And this goes also into how he wants to be remembered as a great historian. That he also feels the need, or thinks he can possibly, satisfy the Jews if he doesn't, if he continues to see Nazism as doing evil things. So he's decided to put it on Himmler as a scapegoat in order to spare Hitler, of whom he likes to say, and I'm just paraphrasing here, I've heard this, he's written it to the extent that I am the man who has saved or will save Adolf Hitler's reputation. You know, and I have a cosmic connection with this man. He had an insight at one time, or a great awakening, that he and Hitler had a destiny together, and his destiny or his work, which he will has accomplished, is to tell the truth about Adolf Hitler, and he's the one. He's the historian. He's the only one who can do this, who has done it, and this has some kind of strong meaning to David Irving. I just want to point out that, I want to talk about Mark Weber one of these days again, but I never find the time to do it. But, you know, Mark Weber used to have Irving at his IHR headquarters in California, but he hasn't been there so far on this trip, but he hasn't been in the U.S. either, so maybe he will. But Mark Weber has just embraced all of Irving's interpretations and conclusions, which tells me that Mark Weber doesn't think on his own, and he never has, but that's something we'll have to wait for another time. But he's just one person who supports Irving in no matter what he says. And then with Irving, there also exists, not necessarily with Irving, but with the people he needs to satisfy, that there is a desire in general to create caricatures of the various Nazis. And Himmler is a favorite one for that. And second is Heydrich, because they were policemen, you know, and the top ones. So, there's little fondness of any kind for Himmler and Heydrich, although there is a mystique and a love for Adolf Hitler that you run up against if you're trying to make him into this evil person. It's very difficult to do, more difficult all the time. So that's part of, and I would like to say a little more about Irving. You know, when Irving started out in his career, he was the golden boy, and he got a lot of attention. He got a lot of rewards and financial rewards, and the press was not against him. Nobody was against him. He was writing some, books, some breakthroughs in historical understanding and so on. But when he got involved in Holocaust, which he did by cooperating with Ernst Sundel in his trial, and then hearing about reading the Leuchter report and being totally convinced by that there couldn't have been any gassings going on, and any real gas chambers. And he thought at the time, obviously still, that truth would prevail. He was trying to be known as the historian that brought out the truth, the only one who really did it. And so he he jumped on this, or at least he accepted it, and he came out with the results of what you would come up with normally by reading the Leuchter report. So obviously he was still a bit naive about the power of the Jews and the power of the rest of the world to go along with them, and what was really the makeup of the English establishment, the English leadership. So he learned a big lesson from that, a very bad lesson in what started to happen to him. And it ended up with his imprisonment in Austria, which was really foolish of him to go there, you know, knowing what everybody knew that they said they were going to do if he ever stepped foot in that country. But he went anyway thinking he was smarter than them. And that's a real big characteristic of David Irving, that he thinks he's smarter than other people. He thinks he can outsmart everyone. He is very smart. And he also has this huge ego, and you put the two together, and you get somebody who has who goes too far, and he's gotten himself in this situation where he sees his whole career, his historical reputation, his reputation as a historian and as a literary person, on into the future. Maybe he will just be wiped out. You know, I mean, this is what I think he's fighting against. He's trying to regain, in some way, some reputation that he won't be destroyed by these people, because he realizes now what they can do. But I guess he still doesn't realize that it doesn't do any good, because he's ruined as far as they're concerned. They're never going to accept him in any, even in any little partial way, I don't think. So he should go all out with it, but instead he's for whatever reasons he's made this decision to say, oh yeah, he's not a denier. Maybe simply because he said in that legal case with what's her name that he was not a denier. It was all about was he a denier or not. So now he has to continue on with the, you know, showing that he's not a denier, no matter what. So therefore, he has embraced the idea, and he says it's his own research and his own interpretations and conclusions that at least a million, and more than a million, actually were Jews, actually were exterminated in the Reinhardt camps during the Action Reinhardt and so on. So this is... I'm gonna just go through some quotes that some things that Irving said in the film, and starting with, let's see, get here. Starting with at the 42-minute, 40-second mark, or somewhere around there, around the 42-minute mark, but at 42:40, he says, in all likelihood, he was put in an extermination camp. So he is acknowledging that there were such things as extermination camps by saying this. The further background of it was that he was talking about the Night of the Broken Glass and telling the story to his listeners. You know, he was having one of these, this is his private meeting with the people who pay to go, and that the anti-fascists are trying to discover where it is and, you know, make a huge protest outside and stop people from going there and so on. But it did take place, there are a few people there, you know, maybe less than 20 or so, but you just mostly see Irving in the video, and you hear some people's voices asking him questions. But he is saying that on the Night of the Broken Glass in 1938, a Jew was taken to Dachau for 3 weeks, along with a bunch, all, you know, they rounded up a lot of Jews and put them in Dachau just to kind of punish them and scare them, and they didn't, but they released them after a short time. And this one was released after about 3 weeks. Irving says, named Oscar Gassler, and the Himmler family, he happened to be the Himmler family lawyer in Munich from the 1920s. And Himmler wrote then, when he was 22 years old, that he had to go and see this lawyer. His father sent him for some purpose for his father. And he said that he disliked the man. He disliked him right away, just his manner and the way he behaved and so on. He was trying to really get along with the young Himmler. But Himmler said about the Jews, they can't help it. It's in their blood. Well, Irving got this from a diary of somebody's. I don't think it was his, but he said, supposedly he said that. That's just one little interesting comment. But, excuse me, Irving tells us that 20 years later, no, this was when he was 22 years old, he went to see that man, not, you know, during the Night of the Broken Glass. 20 years later, when this incident happened in 1938, this Jewish lawyer, Oscar Gassler, is about to board a deportation train in Munich, and somehow Irving learned that he had been deported from Munich, but he doesn't know what happened to him after that. This old lawyer, acquaintance of Himmler's family. And he says his Jewish friends tell him, David, you can't leave it like that. You have to tell us what happened to him, what happened to the Jewish lawyer who got deported supposedly from Munich. And Irving says to his Jewish friends, well, I don't know. Well, and his Jewish friends say to him, well, just say he was put in an extermination camp. And Irving says, in all likelihood, he was. I can't say that he was, though. So, by saying in all likelihood he was, confirms that David Irving is asserting that there were extermination camps. And David says, a lot of the time you can't join the dots. Well, a lot of the time you can't join the dots. You know, he joins a lot of dots. But when he can't do it, he says, well, you can't always join all the dots. But when he thinks he can, you know, he makes a case for joining them. Now, at the 50-minute mark of this video, he says some things that I particularly think are interesting as a woman. So he says, women can be predatory. Now, let's think about David Irving and his history. He's a little bit of a male chauvinist, and he likes young women, young attractive women. And he says he says things about everybody, including racial comments, and he's gender comments, and so on. So, you know, that's okay. But I just want to point out what he's saying here. He's saying at the 50-minute mark that Heinrich Himmler at age 24 or 25 is still not interested in women. Well, how does he know? But that's what he says. And he says at that time, this 32-year-old woman got her fangs into him. He's talking about the woman that Himmler married, and she was 7 years his senior. That's all, 7 years. Not the ideal, but anyway, he says about these women who get their fangs into younger men. We call them Cubas, don't we? Cubas? Well, I don't know what a Cuba is, but that's how he pronounced it. Maybe somebody will be able to write in or call in and let me know. Let us know. But he goes on and says that's what Marga, that's the name of the woman, came along. That's what Marga came along when she was desperate for a child. I left out the word did. That's what Marga did when she came along. When she was desperate for a child, she was divorced, and there was this nice young man. She went after Heinrich, and a few months later, they were married. So he speaks very derogatorily about Himmler's wife. and makes it seem like she was a woman who was desperate for a child after being divorced, and she saw this little Himmler who seemed like such a non-fighting type of person, not aggressive, and at the age of 24, 25, this is how he pictures Himmler, this little wimpy guy who couldn't stand up to her. And then, so he went ahead and married her, and then he talks about how Himmler had a mistress later on, which I'll get into. But first, let me say, what you read on Wikipedia, which is, you know, politically correct, it's certainly more objective than a whole lot of sites that you're going to find on the internet. That's why I continually go there, because when you go other places, it gets even worse. So on Wiki here, let me quick look in my mailbox, because somebody was maybe going to send me something. Where is this? Oh, during the program. Here it is. Oh, well, it's from Carlos Porter. He hasn't sent it yet. He's going to see if they'll copy from a book. He's telling me, he sent me something about the Annapolis schools. That's some interesting information from a book. He said he would try to photocopy it. And I said, well, if you can send it, you know, right away, maybe I can add it to the program. Anyway, that hasn't come yet, and there's no other messages yet. So Himmler, Wikipedia says Himmler met his future wife, Margaret Bowden, in 1927. She was 7 years his senior. She was a nurse who shared his interest in herbal medicine and homeopathy, and was part owner of a small private clinic. They were married in July 1928, the next year, and maybe it was only a number of months, I don't know. Well, it would have to be over 6 months. And their only child, Gudrun, was born on 8th August 1929, which would be 13 months later, so that's all very appropriate. And the couple were also foster parents to a boy named Gerhard von Ahe, son of an SS officer who had died before the war. So probably Himmler was willing to take in this boy. Himmler liked kids. And of this SS officer, and Margaret was willing, and so they did. So they had their own daughter, and they had this kind of like foster or adopted. They adopted him, this adopted son. Margaret sold her share of the clinic and used the proceeds to buy a plot of land in Waltrudering near Munich, where they put up a prefabricated house. Himmler was constantly away on party business, so his wife took charge of their efforts, mostly unsuccessful, to raise livestock for sale. Well, this sounds to me like a pretty solid relationship, and there was reasons why Himmler thought that he wanted to marry Margaret, not being so concerned with the fact that that she was a little older than him. So, you know, they married and they had all these things in common, and she sounds like a hard worker. Now, what I might talk about a little bit forward, but, you know, she kept a diary, and Irving met her after the war, after everything was over, and he won her over, obviously, and she gave him her diary, or a copy of it or something, and he used it, and he's translated it. It's on his website. I was reading it last night, and I was enjoying it very much. She's, sounds all right to me. She's a very German woman, very Germanic character and mentality and so on. And, you can, if you're not like that, you can think, well, I don't care for this woman. She sounds sort of cold and she's so, but you know, she was always saying she had, you know, she only was writing the least little bit in her diary just to keep up with things. And then she says she doesn't want to be complaining. Sometimes she complained life was hard for her. Well, it was because her husband was away all the time. And she loved her daughter, and she took good care of the boy, too. And he was a kind of a, didn't do all that well. And although he tried. And the daughter, Gudrun, turns out to be, she's always saying she's doing very poorly in school, but they loved her dearly. And she was a delightful girl, but I guess she wasn't the greatest student. So all this was going on, and then the war, and she goes all the way to 1945, but sometimes she only writes in it every other month or, you know, once a month, or she wrote more in the beginning. But, I think that I just want to stop here and just say that I think that Irving, by portraying her in the way he did in this video anyway, talking to this meeting, is really unkind and anti-female, period. To just pick on this woman because he wants to portray Heinrich Himmler in a certain way. And I don't think it fits at all. And I guess I'll stop there. Irving is known to like young women and to have these this beautiful young secretary that he's, you know, has to have around him all the time, and to have had women leave him, and he's bitter about some ex-wife of his that has, he thought, took all of his money or so on. So he has a lot of issues there that he's dealing with. And that's, I bring this out just because it can reflect on everything that he writes, that he is, he brings his own personal issues to it. You know, that he's not the objective historian that you would like to think. Now, probably in his younger years, in the beginning, he was, because he didn't have all these issues. But as life goes on, you know, we get more and more issues, and he's now kind of fighting for his career and his recognition on into the future. So he does a lot of things that he's not beyond it. Let me just put it that way. He's not at all beyond not being objective in the way that he wants to think. Now, where I stopped off. Okay, they were married, and all right. Now, a little bit more, I guess I should say this now. Okay, well, then he talks about how Himmler started an affair with his secretary, which he did, and eventually he made her his mistress, and she had two children by him. And but this didn't happen until 1939. This Hedwig Posthast was Himmler's secretary since 1936, but in 1939 she became his mistress. So they'd probably been flirting, and who knows what was going on there, but finally she may have gotten pregnant because they had a son, Helga, born in 1942. So for that reason, she quit her job in 1941. And he arranged accommodations for her in Mecklenburg and later at Berchtesgaden. Not in Hitler's home, obviously, but in one of the houses down around there, and, you know, in that complex and so on. So that he could be, when he was there, he could be close to the Führer, because he was, you know, around the Führer so much of the time, needed to be. So they had this son in 42, and they had a daughter born in 1944 down there at Berchtesgaden. And her name is Nanette Dorothea. And Margaret, according to Margaret's diary that goes all the way to 1944, you would never know this. She never mentions anything like this. But, it says that she learned of this relationship in 1941. And she was living most of the time in Gmund, which is on the outskirts of Munich, with Gudrun, who they called Puppi, or Puppi, U with a umlaut, you know, like in Führer, Puppi, which is a nickname, which is a cute nickname for a little girl, which means Dolly, D-O-L-L-Y. And so they always call her mother always refers to her as Pirpi, never Gudrun, in her diary. And he said that Himmler wanted her, they moved there together, and he wanted her to be there most of the time, but she was not stuck there. I mean, she was the wife of Heinrich Himmler, and she was invited to all kinds of things, and she went on some trips, and some of them with him, and during the war years, and she had a lot of things to do, but she still felt very lonely, because she would say fairly often that she was not very happy, and that Heinrich, she called him H. He was always referred to as H. He was always busy, always with the Fuhrer, always doing his duties. She never intimated anything other than that. And so, couldn't get home very often, but he called her. He continued to call her pretty regularly. Well, I say all this because, in the Wikipedia article, they say that they separated. Here it is. It says, she learned of the relationship in 1941, and Wikipedia says she and Himmler were already separated, and she decided to tolerate the relationship for the sake of her daughter. Well, they were not officially separated, because he still came home up to 1945, and he still went, they still did things together, and I wouldn't call that a separation. They're just assuming that they had some kind of, that wasn't the same after that. Well, probably wasn't. But anyway, Margaret, being the wife of a very prominent person, had to be doing things for the war, too. And being a nurse from the past, she went to work for the Red Cross during the war. And then she was appointed supervisor in Military District 3 in Berlin-Brandenburg. And she talks about all this in her diary. And so she spent quite a bit of time in Berlin. And so, you know, I mean, she was busy. She did her part. She sometimes talked about bad health. She had this and that health problem, but they might have just been passing things. The kind of thing you'd write in your diary, you know. And so if I had a diary, I'd write all that kind of stuff. Well, I don't feel very good today. Something like that. Anyway, and, you know, different little problems that Poopy has. But she's always talking about Himmler. And speaking well of him and how hard he's working, and she's so proud of him, he's doing so well, all the way up to 45. So I don't think this woman should be talked about the way she's being talked about. And knowing that her husband had this other woman, she tolerated that too. And she was very loyal German. She was very into the war. She said some things that weren't very flattering about Jews and Poles a couple of times, which could make people not like her. But, you know, that was the idea, because the German people, if you are loyal to the National Socialist regime of Adolf Hitler, you knew that the Jews and the Poles were the enemy, because they were behaving as the enemy. And there's a whole lot to back that up. So, you know, you weren't talking about them in a lovey-dovey way at all. Now, to move on here, at the 52-minute mark, around 52:19, or, you know, just around there, Irving says, in 1942, Himmler writes to Hedwig, or I wasn't sure if he meant Hedwig, his mistress, or a woman in America, because he said that there was a woman in America that had 200 letters from Heinrich Himmler during the war. Not love letters, necessarily, but letters. 200. He said he saw them. He said she let him read them, but then she didn't let him copy them on the advice of her lawyer or something like that. It would take away their value if he could copy them down. So, Bob wasn't sure here who he was meaning that Himmler had written to, but he wrote these words that Irving says are very meaningful. And Himmler wrote, I am going to spend the next few weeks in Poland. And then there are certain things that I have to do for Germany's sake that are not very nice. Now, Irving says, this sentence is pure gold. Oh, this really tells us. That really tells us something. That Himmler in 42, I didn't get the month. I don't know if it's there. Wrote to a woman. A woman who's got tender, you know, women are supposed to have tender feelings and you don't want to tell anything bad to them. That he has things he has to do for Germany that are not very nice. He, you know, he doesn't say what it is, but Irving thinks he knows what it is. And, you know, the fact is that Joseph Goebbels wrote similar things like that. He talked about the things not being very nice and it was too terrible to talk about and so on. But he didn't necessarily extermination, murder, gassing, shooting, or, you know, in large scale necessarily. Now, Irving says that Himmler's war diaries are missing, and he's searching for them. And he talked about this 200 letters. He said he wrote 200 private letters to Hedwig. So I guess she got more letters than his wife did. His wife got some phone calls. 200 to this woman in America. And I wonder, and then he called his wife regularly. So I wonder when he had time to exterminate the Jews or even anything, all of his responsibilities that he had, if he's writing all these letters to this many letters to people in the course of 3 or maybe 4 years. I guess, you know, one a week or something, it adds up. So that's not too hard to do if they're not long. So at the 59-minute mark, this is an important thing, one of Irving's key points. 900 Jews on a train to Minsk. There were 900 Jews. This is official. They were, you know, documents. They're sent off from somewhere, you know, in Germany. I forget where. But the documentation, and this may be where this is a telegram. He's now into these telegrams intercepted by the British. And he says there's 43 volumes of these telegrams that were top secret. But the British, you know, I don't know if this was what part of their but they had decrypted the codes. And so they were reading all these. I don't know what part of their decryption this was, but they had decrypted it and they were reading all these telegrams that the Germans were sending. 43 volumes of them, he says. And this part was that, was sent that there were these 900 Jews on a train to Minsk with plenty of food. The person sending them said they have plenty of food and all their appliances with them. Meaning things like sewing machines and tools of their trade, you know, so that they could carry on with their trades when they get to their destination. They had food, they had plenty of clothing, they had all these appliances of theirs, they had everything. But Irving says that they were murdered before they got to their ultimate destination. But that the Germans at the starting point did not know that this was the plan. They thought they were actually going to Minsk and other places east, but the plan was to murder them somewhere along the line, according to Irving. And this was Hitler. This was Himmler's doing. This was all Himmler's doing. This is supposed to prove that they sent that the people in the West, meaning Hitler, that Hitler didn't know. Hitler didn't know what was that. Hitler thought that these people were all being sent to the East, and so did all the others there. But Himmler, this sinister Himmler, had this plan of his own that he decided to help things along with, and he was murdering them in these Reinhardt camps before they got to where they were going. He's got another story here of October 5th, but I think, you know, we're going to get into the revisionist view. And the revisionists know better. Revisionists have a lot of information that Himmler is ignoring. But I'll just continue with, I mean, Irving is ignoring. I'll just continue with what Irving is saying, and then I'll get into that afterwards. Another important thing this is his proof. You know, this is what he's using to convince people that Himmler's guilty of this, and Hitler's not. It is October 5th, 1942. The SS police commander Lutz sent a secret message. About 700, top secret, 700 Jews have broken out of the camp at Sobibor, and everything is being done to round them up and bring them back. Now, Irving says, now that doesn't tell us very much, but 2 days later, Himmler orders Sobibor razed to the ground. And he says the reason is clear, because these escaped men might tell what was going on there. So he had to destroy all the evidence. Now, you know, we have to believe that there's no evidence here, but there was a message. There's a secret message that 700 Jews have broken out of Sobibor. We don't learn anything about they were trying to round them up and bring them back. Were they successful? Well, they were usually successful in that. But 2 days later, Sobibor was razed to the ground. I don't know. That's his thing there. I'm sure the revisionists have something to say about that. I haven't gone into all this. So at 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 minute, Irving says, you begin to rewrite history, meaning himself. He says, when you get all this stuff, he was pointing to all these telegrams, all these intercepts that he has. He says, these are platinum. This is solid. Meaning it's better than the witness testimony. You know, this is real documentation, he's saying. And he says, when you get all this kind of stuff like I've gotten, you begin to rewrite history. And he's seeing himself as rewriting history. At 1 hour, 5 minutes, he talks about, he says, the total Operation Reinhardt death number is 1,274,166 killed. And he says he said that the British code breakers, when they got all this information, didn't comment on that it was a killing operation, because he says they didn't know what the numbers referred to. So it wasn't clear what these numbers referred to, but Irving has figured out, you see. Irving is the one who's discovered that this many people were exterminated in these camps. Now, he says Operation Reinhardt continues until October 1943, when Himmler was told that Operation Reinhardt had come to a satisfactory conclusion, and he shut down the remaining camps. And then he tells his people gathered there, because he's going on this trip to Sobibor in a week. I don't know. Oh, Sobibor. No, Sobibor. I shouldn't have that R in there. In a week, and that was from August 30th, so they must be on that trip. I somehow didn't see anything about it, but they must be on that trip by now. And he says to them, when we see Sobibor in a week, you'll find there's nothing there. He's preparing them because there is nothing there, and we'll get into that. But then he tells them, in spite of that, back in the forest, behind, there's a strange dip. And he doesn't say a lot about it here, but he says a little bit. No more than just that there in this one area, there's this strange dip. And this, I guess, is supposed to be some kind of burial ground where a lot of stuff is buried, all these bodies. Because, as we know, there has never been any... There's never been anything, any excavation at any of these camps that's ever come up with any bodies, except, you know, a body here or there of naturally you'd bury one or two or three, or, you know, a few people who die when they're there, but, no mass graves of any kind. But yet he can say that these documents show that there are all these people killed. And that they were killed, he thinks they were killed in these camps, that for whatever reason he has, they never made it, you know, out of Poland. But there's no body, there's no evidence of remains, so that's something that Jürgen Graf talks to him about. So Then he goes in and at 1 hour, 7 minutes, Irving says Hitler tells Himmler gypsies are not to be liquidated. He says, unfortunately, these are Irving's words. The train load of 1,000 had reached Riga. Latvia, Lithuania, and were already dead. This is what Irving thinks when Hitler said that. Himmler then blamed it on Jekyll, who was the police commander. But he didn't punish him. He didn't really discipline him. Irving admits that he blamed it on Jekyll in some kind of, only in a conversation or something with somebody else, or, you know, in a letter he wrote or something, just saying that Jekyll overstepped his bounds. And then he wrote something to Jekyll saying, you are guilty of overstepping the bounds of what you were asked to do, and you know you need to report to such and such place, and for you know discipline, and you, no more of that. That's all he did, supposedly. So then, could just tell Hitler if Hitler questioned it, if Hitler found out about it, which didn't seem like he did, that he hadn't done it, that it wasn't he, Himmler. And so then, Irving says that there was no, after that incident, there was no more killing for several months. And that Hitler, and he deduces from this, he concludes that Hitler stepped in at this point and stopped it. This is what he likes to say. We've got something else here, but I don't know where it went, but maybe I didn't write it out. He's always saying that Hitler, from the beginning, he said from the beginning, Hitler was always putting his hand out to stop harm to the Jews. This is what Irving's telling us. He's telling his people who come to his meeting. From the beginning, we find that Hitler, always would step out, put his hand out, and stop harm being done to the Jews. I don't believe that. Do you believe that? I don't believe that. He knew what needed to be done about the Jews, but he didn't have it wasn't extermination. It wasn't killing. But you know, see, here's where it's kind of shocking that Irving looks as bad as he does when he says things like this. Now, maybe there's some explanation, and I'm not an expert on all these details, and what details I ever learn I seem to forget, so I have to refresh myself. So I don't forget all of them, depends on how much I've worked with them, but you know, I don't have all this down, but I think that I've read enough revisionist work to say that there's something wrong with this, and I feel like I know enough about Hitler. You know, just like with the Negroes, Hitler is not a friend to these people. And Irving wants to make Hitler out to be a friend of the Jews, so to speak. And then he goes on about how, well, Hitler said, and he did say that, you know, we'll just deport them and we'll deal with what needs to be done. But he said we'll deport them into Russia, and we'll deal with what needs to be further action after the war. So, but he wants to make out that Hitler was really big in protecting the Jews. Now, at 1 hour, 8 minutes, somewhere around in there, Irving says there is one more source. And this is the last one I'm going to give for this business about Himmler. He does talk about more things, and he talks about Eichmann, and he talks about Himmler's death, but that's not, I can't cover all of that today, so we're going to stop here. There's one more source, is the English Interrogation Center, where he says all the top German prisoners were brought there and kept together in the best conditions with hidden microphones in the ceiling and so on to record their conversations. So all these top-level Germans who were taken prisoner of war were allowed to stay in their uniforms and wear their decorations and, you know, carry their sabers or whatever, and, you know, had lots of great food to eat. And they were just treated wonderfully. And then they were, you know, in these rooms together, and they're in, you know, where they could talk and chat and everything. And the British were listening on these hidden mics. Now, do you think these Germans wouldn't have had that idea that that might be happening? Anyway, this has been in the newspapers, at least some version of it, where they had these German officers in custody, and they put them all together, and they were talking together, and they said all these incriminating things. And one of the things that Irving thought was most impressive, that it was true and wouldn't be something that somebody made up, was when this top general said that he was watching some of these Jews being assassinated, being shot and buried in the forest or something. He said he told the story of a beautiful Jewess wearing a bright red dress. Oh, he remembered this beautiful Jewish woman wearing a bright red dress. And this is convincing to Irving. What of those people would be wearing bright red dresses anyway? They weren't dressed like that, people who were arrested. And I don't think Jews wore bright red dresses. Not observant Jews. So, I mean, there's something I find. This sounds like a fake story, but Irving makes a big deal about how, oh, that's something you'd really remember. You didn't say that. You didn't really remember. You're right. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and this is Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn on the White Network. It is Saturday, September 7th, 2013, and I have spent the first hour on Heinrich Himmler, on David Irving's revelations that have come out to the public about his book. His book is not finished yet. You know, he's been promising this book on Himmler for what, 3 or 4 years now? Seems like it. And as soon as he decided to write it, he made an announcement. So he'd have everybody interested. And, you know, I'd like to be friendlier toward David Irving, but he makes it very hard. So on his website, you know, he's always got some little new thing about his Himmler book. He keeps people following along and, you know, listening to him and waiting and so on. And now after all this time, he's talking about the book. He's telling us more and more about. Now, my theory as to why he's telling us about this book. I just got a phone call. I guess I better answer it. Darn it. I'm trying to say something here. But okay, let me get on the Skype page and answer this call. It just hung up. Well, they'll probably call back. Okay, the fact that he keeps, you know, kind of teasing us with this book reminds me of what's it? Guy writing about Elie Wiesel. Now I've forgotten his name. But you know, where he keeps talking about it still hasn't come out. But I think the reason for that is because he doesn't want us to be let down by it. He's letting us know what is in the book, what's going to be in the book, here it comes again. Okay. What's going to be in the book so that we won't say, gee, this book isn't what I thought it would be. Hold on, 277. Okay. All right. Hello, caller.
Oh, hi. This is Patty from New York.
Well, hi, Patty.
Hi. I'm calling because when I first started out exploring real history, I thought David Irving was like one of the top people to go to, his books. And I read his book, Hitler's War, and I came across, I left that book with a very negative feeling about Hitler. But then I read Pat Buchanan's book, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War, and I got a very favorable image of Hitler. So then when David Irving said that he believed 3 million Jews died in the Holocaust, I thought there has to be something wrong here, and that perhaps David Irving did have an agenda. Maybe it's an agenda to get some favor from the Jews, you know, some recognition or something. So I don't really know, you know, what David Irving's whole shtick is, but I do know that I went to see him in Manhattan. He sometimes comes to America and gives the tours, talks about an aspect of history, and you know, his meetings are usually attacked by the Antifa group, and I felt that, and they were, our meeting was attacked, even though he supposedly did all he could to protect us, you know, protect the site. And they did show up that day and pepper sprayed several people, and we were in a room that didn't lock, the door didn't lock, and I just felt that I couldn't understand why he wouldn't take better precautions to protect his audience. So, I don't know. I'm a little very skeptical about David Irving at this point, and I did want to read his book on Goebbels, but now I'm deathly afraid to. I think he's just going to tear the man apart. That's all I
wanted
to say.
Well, I understand. Yeah, people say that. Well, thanks, Patty. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, because you've actually been to one of David Irving's meetings, which I have not. Okay, we've got another caller on the line. What is your name, please?
It's John. John?
Yeah, hi, John. Where are you from? Where are you calling from, John?
Mississippi. We've talked before.
Okay, John. What do you want? I mean, what do you want to say?
What do I want? I want a lot of things, but nobody can help me out.
I don't want to go. I don't want you. Let me continue for a while. And if you find something that you can comment on, you comment, okay?
No, I'm saying you were talking about David Irving. Number mm-hmm. one, he lost all credibility with me when he came out and said that the Second Amendment, we shouldn't have the Second Amendment.
I remember when that happened. Well, I don't want to get into that.
The guy's not what he purports to be. But
yeah,
number two, in addition to all the entire world's problem, okay, this whole Syrian thing, this is the world isolating the United States.
I understand all that, and I know people want to talk about Syria right now, but I do want to stick with the topic of this show. And I could talk about Syria, too, but that's just not what we're talking about. I don't want to get off because I've got a lot to say yet about the Napola schools. I don't know how interested you are in that. But let me continue on here with David Irving for a little bit, and you can hold on and see if you have something you want to comment about it. And that is that I forget what I was saying, but I think I may have finished it. Going to Margot's diary, just real quick, there's a few things she said that I thought were worthy of being repeated. And this is not Margot, it's Marga. Actually, it's Margaret, Himmler's wife, Margaret, she was called Marga. And she was talking in 1939 about, this is March 1939, before the invasion of Poland. And she was saying that, you know, she said Prague was taken peacefully. People are so dumb and fight with each other. I think she's referring to that the people of Prague were intelligent, more intelligent, and they didn't, they allowed the Germans to kind of take over peacefully, and that people shouldn't be fighting about these things. And she says, we are fortunate to have a Führer, a brain. That's a real statement of support for Hitler, I think. And that's the general idea that the German people had, that he was very smart, that he had done a fantastic job up to that point, and they had all this faith in him. And they weren't going to start criticizing him now or not having faith in him. And she said, she talked about going to the new Reichschancellery. And she said, the Führer showed us the new Reichschancellery. What harmony of color. So many dark and intense colors. Wood and marble on one wall. Beautiful pictures and gobelins. It's not quite ready yet. And then she says that their adopted son, Gerhard, is Gerhard passed the exam of admittance for the National Political Educational Institute in Spandau. That's what I'm going to be talking about. You know, the NPEA, the Napola schools. And she says, I am happy about that. I hope everything continues to go well. He's not all that old, but they took in even young students, even in the, much, much younger age group. And I'll get to that in a minute. So in the end, it didn't go well because he couldn't keep up with it. And sometime later, she said that he had to leave. And she was sorry about that, but that's the way it was. And but he was a good boy. He went to another school, and then he did. He was still quite young when he went to serve in 1945 in the Wehrmacht. So I don't know what happened to him. I guess he survived. I didn't hear anything other than that. But she does say here on March 7th, she said, I went to Posen, Lodz, and Warsaw. This Jew trash, these Polacks, most of them don't even look like human beings, and the indescribable filth. Well, that's what she wrote in here. Yeah. So this was, a German woman who is looking upon what she finds in these, probably in these ghettos type places. That's what she thinks. So you kind of know there's a lot of support for this. She says on September 3rd, I believe in the Fuhrer and that our country is neither destined to nor can go under. Well, this is September 3rd, 1943. Things, you know, things are not looking as well as they had been. So she's saying that, you know, she's trying to keep her spirits up. And that the Fuhrer had told them that their country is neither destined to nor can go under. And so she's believing it. And on August 11th, 1944, after the assassination attempt of July 20th, I know that the big one, the one that's called that name, God Almighty, they made the big movie about that. Boy, if I don't have people's names in front of me, I cannot remember them anymore. Stonemeyer, what was the stuff? Can't come up with it. Anyway, she writes, "What a disgrace. German officers wanted to bump off the Fuhrer. It's a miracle that he is alive. I was just on my way down here. July 20th was the day. Nothing like this ever happened in the history of Germany," she writes. I want to... you know, I posted a few days ago on CarolynYeager.net the last of the letters of Leopold Wenger of his time at Napola in Koslin. The Koslin School is up in Pomerania, close to the Baltic Sea, actually, and he found out about it down there in Austria. He and his best friend, Gilbert Geisendorfer, and they applied, and they were invited to come up and take tests and so on, which they did. And so he went all the way up there from Austria, and he had always been very superior, you might say, and certainly in his athletic accomplishments and in his seriousness about the National Socialist Party and Hitler and so on. And so he did very well. They both did well, and they got accepted, and they were in that school in their last year of school, or maybe part of their seventh year, and then in their eighth year, which is the last year in Germany, equivalent to what we call 12th grade. And so I posted these letters on my website. Some people seem to think they're kind of boring. Other people, it depends on if you're interested or not. Other people are real interested in it, and there's a lot of readers of it. I wish there were more, though. But I find it very interesting, just like I find this diary of Himmler's wife very interesting. She's just talking about a lot of little this and that most of the time, you know, who she's going to see. Of course, these are recognizable names, wives of... other big party bigwigs and government bigwigs, but sometimes she's visiting, you know, she's at the Fuhrer's, she's invited to this or that, that the Fuhrer is giving, and things, you know, but it's a lot of it is just not anything. But I like that. I like to hear people, I like to read people writing about their life, if they're in a time and a period that's of great interest to me. So, I've talked about these Napola schools before. It was on, I think, June 24th on the Heretics Hour program. But this has caused me to want to talk about them again, because I just want to encourage people to read those letters. And I have got all this material that this Leopold, quote, BB, unquote, Wenger wrote during his time during World War II as a Luftwaffe pilot, and his family saved them all, and his brother, his younger brother Willie, has all this stuff in his possession. He's sent it all to me, and we're just getting it translated as we go along. And so I don't know what all is in it, but I know I'm going to keep posting it, and I think I'm really anxious to read it all myself when it gets into English. So when I look at that big blocks of German writing, I'm just at a loss as to where to start. You know, it take me forever to try to make any sense out of it, so I don't. Unless I have to. One sentence here or there, sometimes I do. But, you know, when you try to look for something about these schools on the internet, there's very little. There really is very little. Let me look and see if Carlos Porter has added anything. Well, here's something from Himmler, from Stewart on Himmler. I'll take a look at it. Well, he's saying the same thing I'm saying. He doesn't believe in Irving. He doesn't think that Himmler was doing things on his own. He agrees, and that the policy was transfer, not extermination. Okay. Now, you know, there's somebody else who wrote to me about it, and that was contact. Or here's a new one. Oh, that's yeah, and Enzog has written quite a bit, but he says pretty much, I'm not going to read it all because it says pretty much what I've been saying, and he's just great, happy that I'm talking about this, and he's very angry at David Irving, too, for what he's saying. So I think David Irving is aware of that, and he's a little bit worried about it. I know what part I didn't get into that I wanted to, and I've got it right here, and that is Jürgen Groff's, what Jürgen Groff wrote to Irving. I need to take a few minutes to cover that, and then I can still cover the Annapolis schools. You can find this at what Jürgen Groff wrote. Some of you may be familiar with it. To David Irving, kind of an open letter type thing. It's very long. It's at jurgen-groff.vho.org/articles/David Irving, blah, blah, blah. So just Jürgen Groff, David Irving will do it, or you might add VHO to it, and you'll find it. It is called, it's just Jürgen Groff's site that's associated with VHO. So he writes, okay, in March 2007, I got an email from David Irving who informed me that he was in Poland where he was visiting the Action Reinhardt camps, Reinhardt with a T on the end, camps. According to German wartime documents, the purpose of Action Reinhardt consisted in the confiscation of Jewish property. Without a shred of documentary material evidence, the Orthodox historians claim that the real purpose of this action was the physical liquidation of the Jews of Eastern Poland, and that between 1.5 and 2 million Jews were killed with carbon monoxide from diesel engines in three camps, Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. Traditional history has it that these camps were pure extermination centers where all Jews, regardless of age, health, etc., were gassed without registration and so on. But as I've already talked about, you know, that there's no evidence of bodies being buried there or even ashes, you know, from all those bodies, which is a tremendous amount of ashes. And then he talks about Sobibor and Treblinka and Belzec too and some other things in Auschwitz. And he says, my questions to David Irving, and his reply, all right. So in answer to David Irving's, email to him, and knowing what David Irving was up to, he asked some questions, and they were, okay, there's a little preview here, but I'm just going to ignore it. They are, one, did he believe that a mass murder of Jews had taken place at Treblinka, Sobibor, and Belzec? If he believed that such a mass murder had indeed been committed, what was his evidence? Number three, in this case, how was the massacre carried out? And number four, had he, David Irving, read Carlo Mantegna's book about Belzec and the book Treblinka Extermination Camp or Transit Camp, written by Carlo Mantegna and me? And he received a reply from David Irving the same day, and he said, in my opinion, a mass extermination took place in the aforementioned three camps, It cannot be proved that it was carried out by means of gas. As you know, this is highly controversial. And he gives the evidence. Correspondence between Wolf and Gonsenmuller concerning Malkina Treblinka. Well, this Wolf was Himmler's aide. And also Himmler's order not to leave any traces at Treblinka and later to build a farmhouse there. Well, these are questionable sources for these things. And personal interrogation of two witnesses and the decoded Hufla radio message from January 1943. Well, most people are familiar with that if they've been following what Irving has been writing. And then number two, his number two reason, he said he had how many reasons? I'm losing my place here. He said, okay, well, number two, he said the evidence. No, that's not it. Number two, for 1942, that's about the Hufla telegram. Okay, well, that's it. And then he says, David Irving gave him clear answers to the first three questions, but he did not answer the fourth one, whether he had read Carlo Mantegna's book on something, and whether he had read Treblinka, the Treblinka book written by both Carlo Mantegna and Jürgen Graf. And so he's talking about all the sources of in these books that they write that they've gotten their information from. The bibliography of the Treblinka book has 80 titles in it, and 18 of them in the Polish language. So they have got a lot of, they have looked over a lot more stuff than David Irving has, is what he's saying. And if Irving did not consider it necessary to read these two books by Mantegna and one of them also by Graf, it shows he's not in the least interested in what really happened at Treblinka and Belzec. Of course, it is quite possible that he has indeed read them, but is reluctant to admit it because otherwise he would be forced to respond to the revisionist arguments, especially the technical ones. As a matter of fact, as soon as one approaches the official version of the Reinhardt camps from the technical angle, the whole edifice of lies immediately collapses. Jürgen Graf is convinced absolutely that no extermination took place at these camps and that they were transit camps. And he stands his ground on this, and others do too, I believe. And David Irving is presenting this stuff and looking for people who will believe him, people who are not really Holocaust deniers. In fact, in that meeting that we saw, that we can see the video of, he seems to be expecting the people to be kind of anti-Hitler. And he's surprised when they keep asking questions and making comments, or he feigns, not really surprised, but he feigns that, it's not what he expected or something, that these people know so much, for one thing, about the Holocaust, and that they're not shocked by anything that he says in favor of Hitler, what have you. So I think he's trying to reach a different bunch of people to buy his books than people like us. And maybe these are but it's people like us who go to his meetings and pay him to go there, seems to me. So, then Jürgen Graf goes into a lot of detail. You know, I just David Irving's the missing answer to the fourth question, the David Irving's evidence for the mass murder of Jews at all three Reinhardt camps, David Irving's death toll for the Reinhardt camps, the diesel gas chamber story, and I'm only halfway through, and you know, on and on and on. So he proves right here that David Irving is wrong and doesn't have, you know, is going with, you know, is going in the wrong direction here. But that hasn't stopped David Irving, because this was written back in somewhere around 2009. So it's, but I would advise anybody who hasn't read that, who hasn't seen that, is not familiar with the arguments, to, you can just go there right there on the internet. You can, of course, buy those books too. And some of them, it may be that the first one you can read on the internet. I don't know. But this is this is important information here. So now, getting back to, took care of that, getting back to the NAPLA, why they don't want you to learn much about these schools. And when they talk about these schools, they make out that they were different than what they were. You know, there was this film after, no, before the fall that some Germans made in Germany, but recently, like in the 1990s, was it, or something? And I've forgotten. But they've, you know, where they try to portray some young people at Annapolis school. And, you know, it's this intricate story where there's this, these nasty bullies. And the thing is, the head of the school is a sadist. And the SS officers and the teachers and so on, they're all bad people. And there's this one boy who through his sufferings as a boxer, because they want him to be a boxer, wakes up to the fact that, you know, he had been brainwashed to believe that that the Hitler regime was good, and he wakes up to the fact that it wasn't. And then he helps some Jew, you know, the usual stuff that they come up with. And they do, and it's just totally false. And maybe I'll start with this little thing here. At a site called German History Documents, they have a little box where they say, have a picture, a picture of Adolf Hitler visiting the National Political Educational Institute, NAPLA, in Graz, Austria, G-R-A-Z, in April 1941. And these are younger kids, the younger ones, younger than what Leopold was when he first went. He was only there about a year. Let's see, he went in, now he was there. He went in, I think he got started in March of 1939, something like that, and he was graduating in September and November, and being inducted into the Luftwaffe as a cadet. So that's he wasn't even there that long. One thing that he said that never got into the letters, because it was kind of edited out. Previous to when I saw it, and I didn't get it, I didn't find a place to add it in there when I added some more to the middle group of letters. And it was that he was talking about the younger students there, and they called them, I forget now what they called them. Anyway, they called them the little kids, you know. And, they were like, grade school age, I guess, or maybe 10, 12, 13, something like that. And they were pretty rough. He said that they did a lot of, in their dormitories, these younger boys, they did a lot of roughhousing, I guess. And, it was allowed because they wanted, the National Socialist idea was that boys are not like girls, and they didn't think it was right for boys to sit all day at a desk in school studying and writing and, you know, doing schoolwork and so on. That it wasn't natural, and that boys didn't need to all become scholars, because they had very high standards in German education, always. And when you graduated from the gymnasium, which would be like our high school, eighth grade, they called it, it was like probably like our college. They were probably far better educated back then than our college students are today, or maybe ever were. Because our education has gone to hell. And if you graduate from high school, it doesn't mean much. Of course, some people graduate from high school and they're great. You know, they've done real well. They're very smart and they're the top notch students. But for the most, it doesn't require all that much. So I'm saying these younger kids, they thought they didn't need, you know, they needed more time outdoors. The National Socialist Education was, had a lot of time spent, even for the girls, not as much as the boys though, outside, in sports and so on. And they thought that was far better for them than too much sitting indoors, all the daytime hours. So, and then going home and doing tons of homework, you know, they always had a lot of homework, hours of homework. So, that's the way they did it. So they wanted these young boys in Napola to let out their aggressiveness, to be able to compete with one another, to be able to even, you know, fight with one another if they got into some few fights or something. And they did a lot of roughhousing, I guess. And Beebe mentioned that there was at least, but it was allowed. He said they seemed to allow it. And there was, at least one window broken every week. Or maybe he said more often than every week, but they would even break the windows. But he said it was allowed for that to happen. I guess they just replaced the windows. So this gives probably part of the reason that they can say that they think that these schools were brutal and that children were injured and harmed and, you know, were treated badly. And it starts out saying on April 20th, 1933, Hitler's 44th birthday, Bernard Rust, then Prussian Minister of Education, founded three national political education institutes, also known as NAPLAs, for the education of the future Nazi elite. Now this, remember, this is the unfriendly article. The schools primarily emphasized military and physical training. By 1939, 16 had been opened. NAPLAs were supposed to provide the army, the SS, and the police with their next generation of officers. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if the NAPLA schools were, yeah, they were political education institutes. So they were for the elite. You know, when was it? You had to be, where do I have that? You had to be associated, a member of the Hitler Youth. I think, I don't know if that was after 1939 or after some other earlier year in the 30s, but you had to, here it is. The NAPLAs were associated with the Hitler Youth after the first year, that is beginning in 1934, NAPLA students had to be Hitler Youth members. They were, however, funded and supported by the Minister of Education. So these schools, excuse me, they were not Nazi party schools. Excuse me for using that word. They were not National Socialist Party schools. They did have those. Those were the Adolf Hitler schools. There's a whole series of Adolf Hitler schools, which were in the, I guess they wanted to have one in every party Gau, that's a district, and they were funded by the National Socialist Party. And Adolf Hitler agreed to let his name be used for these schools. And they were to help, educate future party leaders, you know, for the party. Because where you had the party and the government were separate, although they were linked because of Hitler's wishes, I guess you'd say. So, but the NAPLA schools were the German government, the Third Reich government, was responsible for those. And they were to make sure that they had properly prepared leadership as time went on. This makes sense to me. I mean, I can't think of anything more sensible. And they had high standards, although some people want to say that they were just politicizing these kids, you know. Well, these kids were already politicized. They were already members of the Hitler Youth. They were already convinced, and they're already very patriotic, and there's nothing wrong with that either. That's what's necessary. And they say correctly that administration to the school is based chiefly on presentation of a medical certificate attesting to the applicant's outstanding racial and physical characteristics. Well, you had to prove your racial purity as Aryan. You had to do that. And that you had to show exceptional courage and aggressiveness in athletic competitions. Leopold said that when they took their entrance exam, so to speak, it wasn't what he expected. And it was mostly sports. And they had all kind, you know, participated in all kinds of sports things, as swimming, diving, platform diving, and then what all were they? Gymnastics and I can't think of what all the sports would be, but there's a bunch of them. And then they did have some academic work to do also, because they had high academic standards at these schools. They may have lowered them somewhat after the war started. Things like that happen, you know, in wartime, when more and more as the attention has to go to war and serving in the war and so on, that becomes more important than how much, you know about science and mathematics. Only you need to know what's practical. But he was there in 39. Right, and he was there when in September 39 too, and it says that the Naplas were supposed to follow the standard school curriculum, but they failed to do so because they lacked qualified teachers. See, now I don't think that's true. It may be. See, they say they had very qualified teachers up until the war, when the war got going more and more. Well, all these people had to go and serve in the war, so they may have lacked some qualified teachers, but every place would have lacked them, the regular schools too. So it says that, you know, I say they don't give a source for this. You know, this is the kind of thing that they say in order to be derogatory toward these schools. Then they say the SS ultimately assumed complete control over the Naplas, whereupon their academic standards dropped even further. Well, that again is probably not at all true, because they don't say when it happened or how it's known or anything. They just make that statement. And the SS took over the schools in 1939. Let's see if I can find that information. Hessmeyer. From 1936, the NPEAs were subordinated to the Inspector of the National Political... Okay, well that's... And the National Political Institutes of Education and SS Obergruppenfuhrer, August Hessmeyer. So it was a combination of the education ministry and this SS officer who was in charge of that. And then it says that Hessmeyer was, from 1939 on, Hessmeyer was, that they were part of his office, and they are under then the direct influence of the SS after 1939. Well, there you go again, wartime, and but they kept increasing the schools. Now in the first schools, well, I'm jumping around here too much. The first schools, let's see if there's anything more in this I need to finish with first. Well, I just want to point out this propaganda they put in here. You know, after the war began, the age at which students were inducted into military service steadily declined. That's not really true. It remained, you know, you might have been inducted at the age of 17 going on 18, so that you'd get your papers or something, so that you would be 18 by the time you're actually turned into a soldier. But there were volunteers, and they had, you know, what they're talking about. They said instead of educating the new Nazi elite, Annapolis primarily supplied the movement with younger and younger cannon fodder. Well, this is just hate speech, you know, when you read stuff like that, because they still had to graduate from that school. So they didn't send young kids from those schools into the war. But the regular kids, they had the Volksfront, or the older men, the men who were, you know, at home, they formed into the People's Army. And these younger kids volunteered too, and they wanted to be a part of it. So you'd find sometimes 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds amongst their ranks, you know. But they were on the home front. They were trying to defend their towns and cities and so on. But, you know, when you look at these resistance organizations that they glamorize so much, that were against the Germans and against the Axis powers, well, they used kids all the time, and they didn't see anything wrong with that. That was supposed to be just wonderful, because everybody was resisting. Well, by the time these younger kids were fighting for Germany, they were resisting too. They were resisting the invader, you know, the Soviet invaders, and then invaders from the West. So it's all the same thing, but they try to make out like there's something sinister and evil about what the Germans were doing. Now, going back to these, I said I was going to talk about why they're totally proper and good and so on. It's because you have to raise a new generation of your people. I mean, you have to keep supplying your system with new leadership. But since they want to make the National Socialist and Third Reich system into something evil and sinister, then when you're trying to have schools that will bring more of these people ready these men, politically you don't have to say politically indoctrinated, but politically educated young men and women who are ready to take leadership positions. Plus, you want to politically educate all of your people. If you are an ethno state, and if you are if you are the kind of state that the Third Reich was, which we now have. The Golden Dawn in Greece, and the Jobbik, and even the current Prime Minister of Hungary wants to make their countries more that way. They want to make their countries independent places for their own people. And to do that, you need to have leaders who feel that way and understand that, and they have to be educated. So all the education in National Socialist Germany was geared toward teaching the young why the way they had things set up was done, and why it was important, and why it was important to love your people and to serve your people, and all of that. I mean, you can't do it if you're going to have a democratic libertarian type education system, where kids are taught that they should just seek get a good education so they can get a good job and they can make money, you know, for themselves. And that doesn't do it. That will never do it. So these kind of schools were necessary, and that's why they set them up. Now, the first three were founded Plön, Potsdam, and Koslin. And the Koslin was the one that Leopold went to. And they didn't have that many at that time, because in It says by 1941 there were 30 of these schools. But a lot of them were started after 1939, actually. So they were busy setting these schools up after Germany was involved in war. So and there was only 6,000 pupils enrolled in all of Germany in 1941. Only 6,000 out of what, 80 million or something? So that's not very much. So this was just, you know, the top group that they allowed in to these schools. Now, I got a phone call, so I guess I will answer it. Okay. Hi there.
To the young, why the way they had things set up was done, and why it was important, and why it was important to love your people and to serve your people and all of that. I mean, you can't do it if you're going to have libertarian type.
Oh, Christ.
Where kids are taught that
sounds pretty terrible, I have to say.
Get a good education so they can get a good job and they can make money, you know, for themselves. And that doesn't do it. That will never do it. So these kind of schools were necessary, and that's why.
Well, thanks, whoever that was. All right, that didn't sound very good either, did it? Let's go back here. All right. Trying to look where it was. So life in a where? Okay, gotta go back further. So this is why these schools were set up the way they were. They weren't places where kids were coddled, and they weren't places where they were, I don't know, I'm running out of things to say here. Many of them, guess I didn't prepare this part very well. From 1936, I already went through all that part. They were, they're actually based on the Imperial Germany cadet institutes that they had earlier in Germany. And they were, for that reason, they were highly selective. Well, I'm not going to answer this phone call because I don't know who it is. Highly selective, and there was only 20% of applicants accepted. Well, that's about what Leopold said. He said there were like 100 and some, and there were only, I don't know how many more there were, but there's a very small number that were actually could be accepted because the program was so demanding. And I was talking about those entrance examinations that were, showed you had to have really top physical fitness, and you had to have the kind of endurance that you could get through the whole series of them in one day. And he said he was totally exhausted at the end of that, but he managed to do it. So that, you know, you had to have that kind of grit and that kind of stick-to-itiveness in order to be accepted, because there are only so many places, only they could only handle so many students in these schools. And they had a lot of applicants. So, as I said, they had a regular secondary school curriculum that placed a greater concentration on physical education and racial and political studies. They were, and they had schools for girls. They had, 4 schools for girls, and they were, no, that's not that. Well, okay. I'm sorry, folks. I'm losing myself here. I'm losing listeners too. I think I will check this out first, the mailbox, and then I'm going to go to. All right, here's some stuff from some people. Somebody wants to talk about the White Rose Group. Dear Carolyn, I wonder what if you could talk about the White Rose Anti-Nazi Group. Well, I don't have any inside information on the White Rose Group, but they were, they've been made into special heroes and heroes of Germany, just like the group that was out that military group that set out to assassinate the July 20th assassination group. They've all been made into heroes. And if you, the idea was that you had, that people who were trying to overthrow their government, those who were disloyal to the Hitler government, were some kind of heroes, you know, which they are now. But at that time, they had to be put into concentration camps because they wouldn't stop doing what they were doing. And if you, it just depends on, let me see, let me go back to another one. No, that's not what I want, that one. Okay, well, my messages, I'm looking at my messages here. So I'm going to go to my website and go into these letters a little bit. One thing I wanted to say was that these boys at these institutions, at least according to what Leopold was talking about, writes about, were all gung-ho. You know, they were. Of course, they wouldn't have gotten in if they weren't, and they wouldn't have even wanted to get in if they weren't. But they're all of one mind. And so, and if you're going to be victorious, if you're going to accomplish anything, you've got to have your people of one mind. The problem we have today is that we're being told all the time that we don't want to be of one mind, that that's some kind of indoctrination, that's some kind of being, robots or something, and that's you're being controlled from above if you have people who are united so tightly and all of one mind. But that was what the aim was in National Socialist Germany, to bring the German people together in a united way so that they could be strong enough to defend themselves against their enemies. And that is, they needed to do that because they did have all these enemies. Now, if you have, him saying, Leopold writing on November 9th to his family, 1939, he says, "Today we got the news about the attempted assassination of the Führer in Munich." Now this would have been, that was that November 8th assassination attempt, where that big bomb went off. And that man, what was his name? They kept thinking that he must be part of a big plot, but it seemed like he was just did that on his own. It was tremendously damaging, and quite a number of people there were killed, and a whole bunch of them were injured, some of them seriously. So, but at the school, he says, we are so outraged about this infamy. The people in town are ranting so much. We will hear the Führer speak tonight. I am very excited. I've been to town a couple of times today. and because we've been dismissed already without furloughing. Just talks like that. And whenever anything like this happens, well, they're all of one mind about it. And that's why they were successful for so long, Germany, in this fight. I guess I've only got 3 minutes left, so I should maybe see if this call is still here. Where is it? No. But so let's see what I can say in these 3 minutes. I'm sorry, this whole, I just kind of fell apart here in the last half hour. I don't know why, but I've run out of things to say. Well, somebody, looks like somebody's trying to call, but I'm not sure. This can't be anything good because it's about time to end the show. So 1 minute. All right. Well, this probably on Monday. I will talk a little bit. I will go into some more things that I've been wanting to talk about and maybe talk a little bit more about David Irving's book on Heinrich Himmler, or a little more about Heinrich Himmler, if I come up with some more stuff. So I've got 30 seconds. Okay, well, it is time. I'm not hearing the cues or the music. So, ladies and gentlemen, I just want to thank you for listening to this show today and tell you that probably I'll be continuing on with some of these same subjects on Monday on the Heretics Hour. So tune in then, and we'll see you then. Good day.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.